Jean's Le Grand and stopped under the side portico of the post office's facade. If the man were following her, he would catch up to her at some point and she'd see him. She saw no one who resembled the man, but the beautifully overdressed woman from the other day walked past, staring down at a stack of mail in her hand. With every step, she shuffled the letter on top to the bottom, a sharp line creasing her lovely brow. A herd of men came around the corner, obscuring Charlotte's view of the woman. She studied the men. None of them proved to be the one she suspected of following her. When they had all passed, she saw a letter lying at the edge of the portico. When no one rushed back to claim it, she picked it up. The letter, in a less than handsome script, was addressed to a Mrs. Jebediah. Mrs. Jebediah herself was already some distance away. Charlotte called after her. She didn't turn around, but headed inside a tea shop. Sometimes Charlotte wondered what women did before tea shops came along and provided venues where an unaccompanied female could dine respectably in public. She could only be thankful that this at least wasn't one of her problems. The tea shop had a fair crowd, comprised mostly of those leaving work from the post office and other nearby establishments having a bite to eat before they set out for home. Against this backdrop of somberly attired men and women, Mrs. Jebediah was as easy to spot as a toucan among pigeons. A waitress in a black dress and a long white apron hurried past, carrying a tea tray toward a table full of clerks. The aroma of eggs, scrambled in plenty of good butter, assaulted Charlotte. She could not in good conscience complain about her current boarding home. It still clung to respectability, tooth and nail, and maintained a semblance of hygiene. For the price she paid, it was a miracle that any meals had been thrown into the bargain at all. She went to each supper full of gratitude, left, still mostly hungry, and filled her tummy the rest of the time with two-day-old bread, bought at steep discount from the bakery down the street. So she wasn't starving, yet. But she also wasn't very far from crawling over broken glass to get to that plate of scrambled eggs and falling face first into it. She stared at the tea tray another moment before resuming her progress toward her quarry, who looked up in surprise as she approached. "Mrs. Jebediah?"
"Yes?"
"I'm sorry to intrude, ma'am, but I believe you dropped this outside the post office." Mrs. Jebediah rose.
"Why, yes. Thank you, Miss..."
Charlotte hesitated. She'd been brought up to be wary of introductions performed without a reliable third party known to both sides.
"Holmes. Delighted to make your acquaintance, Miss Holmes."
Mrs. Jebediah smiled and gestured at a chair.
"Please, won't you sit down?"
Charlotte's eyes widened.
"Thank you, but no, I couldn't possibly impose." "Oh, poppycock, Miss Holmes," said Mrs. Jebediah with gentle exasperation. "You can see plain as day that I'm an old lady hoping for a bit of companionship. Now, if you have more pressing matters or more interesting friends awaiting your attention, or if you routinely run from women past their prime who still dress like peacocks, let me know and we will say our goodbyes. But if you only fear to impose, then shove a few useless rules of etiquette to the side and sit down."
The wildest thought echoed in Charlotte's head. She felt as if she'd met her mother. Her real mother. But still she hesitated. A waitress came by and placed on Mrs. Jebediah's table a plate of scrambled eggs, exactly like the one that had seduced Charlotte a minute earlier, and a ham pie, and a ramekin of potted chicken, and finally, luxury of luxuries, red ripe strawberries, accompanied by a jug of fresh, rich cream. Charlotte's bottom found the chair quite on its own.
"In that case, I shall boldly impose. Excellent. Tea and a place setting for the young lady, Mrs. Jebediah instructed the serving girl.
Right away, Mum.
As you can see, Miss Holmes, I've ordered too much. When I'm hungry, I want one of everything, somehow never remembering that I will be stuffed after two bites. But then food comes, and I'm full of self-recrimination. How I hate letting anything go to waste. Would you mind sparing me those twinges of conscience? Charlotte once again surveyed the bounty before her. I stand ready to undertake my duty to Queen and country, ma'am, and your conscience too. Mrs. Jebediah grinned. I shall be in your debt, Miss Holmes. The waitress came back with plates and cutlery for Charlotte, and an empty cup. Mrs. Jebediah poured for her. Milk? Sugar?
Yes, both.
Charlotte never thought she'd salivate over a cup of tea, and how.
I wish I had your problem of feeling full early and often. For me, it's the opposite. I can't remember the last time I ate until I was completely satisfied.
Mrs. Jebediah stilled. Oh, my. Charlotte realized that her words might be misconstrued.
Please don't think that my circumstances stand between me and a full stomach.
At least, not until lately.
It has been all for vanity, of course. I can sustain somewhere between 1.5 and 1.6 chins, but the moment I have more than that, my looks suffer catastrophically.
Mrs. Jebediah laughed, startled. But surely you exaggerate, my dear.
I assure you I do not. Via scientific trials, I have determined the precise weight to the ounce at which the shape of my face changes to my detriment.
Mrs. Jebediah laughed again. Goodness, Miss Holmes, but you are diverting to speak with. I am confident that at the moment you are at least a stone below that dreaded point on the scale. So shall we fall upon our feast? Her hostess, Charlotte was relieved to note, did not peck like a sparrow, but ate steadily, if sedately. Otherwise Charlotte would have felt conspicuous, gobbling up everything in sight. The potted chicken, spread on richly buttered toast, had to be absolutely the most delicious thing she had ever eaten in her life, until she reached the strawberries and cream, that was, which happened to be the most delicious thing to have ever existed in the history of the universe. There were three strawberries left when Mrs. Jebediah asked, "Do tell me, Miss Holmes, what is it that you do with your rigorous and exacting mind? Surely you haven't devoted all your waking hours to experimenting with your chins and your intake of food?"
"Not all, but a good portion. At the moment, though, I'm trying to find a position as a typist."
"But that would be a waste. Why not seek work that demands more of your abilities? I should hate to see you with your belly full, but your mind criminally underused."
"Most positions for women that use their minds rather than their labour require education and training, which eliminates me from consideration as I have none. And the rest? Well, given what other positions are there, I'd consider myself lucky if I could become a typist."
"You mustn't be so defeatist, Miss Holmes."
"But I am being optimistic in hoping for a typist position. There are so few good positions and so many young women who must support themselves."
"Ah, the woman question. But tell me, Miss Holmes, what do you think you are most well suited to do?"
Charlotte blinked in astonishment. No one had ever asked her that. "May I tell you a secret, ma'am?"
"Yes, I adore secrets."
"I've always told my sister and my parents that I wished to be headmistress of a girls' school. But that's only because I'm greedy, and a headmistress earns 500, possibly 700 quid a year. The truth is, I've no idea what on earth I could possibly do with my particular talent."
Mrs. Jebediah leaned forward. "And what is your particular talent?"
"I'm not sure how to describe it. or even that it is a talent rather than a nuisance. In fact, I learned early in life not to practice it in public, or in private, for that matter. People I know well are just as easily disconcerted by it.
Practice what, Miss Holmes?
Discernment, I suppose.
Charlotte took a deep breath.
I can tell more about you, for instance, than you would want me to know.
Mrs. Jebediah raised a brow. I thought by dressing as I do, I already tell those I encounter everything they could possibly want to know about me.
I do not believe you thought that by dressing as you do, you would broadcast how much you still mourn your husband's passing.
Mrs. Jebediah became very still, her gaze fixed on Charlotte.
My apologies. I shouldn't have...
No, no, please. Don't. I was unprepared, that's all. I'd like to hear how you came by your observation, Miss Holmes.
It was not a request, but a command. Charlotte complied. The black crepe on your hat and your reticule. I saw them the other day. You have on a different hat and a different reticule this afternoon, but they each still incorporate a square inch or so of the same fabric. The Queen wears her widow's weeds for all to see. You wear your slivers of black crepe only for yourself.
Mrs. Jebediah shook her head slowly. Once, twice. What else? What else do you know about me?
You were on the stage, and successfully so.
And how do you know that? A stage performer does not have the equivalent of black crepe to give her away.
Your attire? I suppose I could interpret it as that of a parvenu, but it isn't so much ostentatious as it is intentionally theatrical, which leads me to conclude that you belong to the demi-monde. My mother would have me believe that all the women of the demi-monde are prostitutes who will die penniless and alone. But it's my understanding that the demi-monde is broader than that, and includes others who live unconventional lives without necessarily resorting to Cyprian means to support themselves. At first, however, I was inclined to think that you've been a courtesan at some point, on account of the trace of rouge I see on your lips and cheeks. There's also a substance that reflects light beautifully and gives your skin a smooth appearance. Rice powder? Perhaps?
Arrowroot powder.
I see.
Charlotte made a mental note.
She didn't understand the arbitrary line that declared only loose women resorted to rouge, whereas ladies must pinch their cheeks to achieve a rosier appearance. Yes, given that, I'd first assumed you to be a courtesan or a former courtesan. But your dress changed my mind. You're clearly conveying your status as a demi-mondaine, yet the manner in which you achieve it is curious. You are signalling not the men, but the women. Were you aiming for the notice of the gentlemen? A higher hemline and saucy boots with cut-out patterns would be much more effective. Most of them do not quite grasp that your dress, beautiful as it is de trop. It is left to the ladies, who have been schooled in such things from the moment they can walk, to understand that you are doing them the favour of letting them know they would not wish to associate with you, not without provoking strong disapproval in their own circles. If you weren't a courtesan, then most likely you were a performer. Your voice, your movement, they speak of training and control. But just as important, your posture speaks of pride in your accomplishments, which speaks of success, yet not so much success, or success of sufficient duration, that I would have recognized you from having seen your photographs elsewhere. With a thoughtful look on her face, Mrs. Jebediah lifted the lid on the teapot, peered at the contents inside, and then replaced the lid.
What else do you know about me?
That your husband was young when he died. The older woman nearly came out of her seat.
How can you possibly deduce that?
Customers at nearby tables turned toward them.
Mrs. Jebediah settled back and took a sip of her tea. They waited for their neighbour's curiosity to dissipate.
"Well, Miss Holmes?"
Charlotte turned her teacup a few degrees on its saucer. Gentlemen in their prime, hampered by the opinion of the public and often constrained by already being married, take mistresses from the stage. It is usually the young and the old who do not give a farthing, who have the audacity to pledge their hand to a woman who has entertained the public. And when an old man dies, no matter how well loved he is, it is easier to accept. Death has been in the wings for a while. But when a young man perishes unexpectedly, his devoted wife, who has had every expectation of many more happy years together, suddenly finds herself profoundly alone and descends into a powerful grief that lasts for years upon years. Mrs. Jebediah's throat moved.
"I do apologize," said Charlotte quietly. "It has been pointed out to me that once I start, I do not know where to stop."
Mrs. Jebediah exhaled.
"I can see why you refrain from regularly practicing this absolutely remarkable talent of yours. But please, go on."
"Are you sure, ma'am?"
"I am."
"Well, with one exception, there isn't that much more I can tell. Other than minor details, such as that you've spent some time in India."
"I wouldn't call that a minor detail. But what is this exception you mentioned?"
"Your name is not Mrs. Jebediah. Or at least, that isn't your only name."
Mrs. Jebediah chortled.
"What gave it away?"
"The letter you dropped. It was to be called for not at the general post office, but at the one in Charing Cross. I can well understand why a resident of London might wish to have mail delivered to the post office, rather than her private home. But to be calling for letters at two different post offices? I can only assume that you are running a scheme of some sort, Mrs. Jebediah. Not a criminal one, necessarily, but a scheme nevertheless."
"At this point, Miss Holmes, I'm only shocked that you haven't told me the exact particulars of my scheme."
"I believe it involves newspaper advertisements pointing those interested to write to you. Other than that, not so much."
"Goodness gracious," murmured Mrs. Jebediah. "Knowing everything you do about me before we'd even exchanged a word, the lure of the scrambled eggs must have been powerful indeed."
"It was the strawberries and cream that did me in, I believe."
Charlotte glanced at the three remaining strawberries before looking back at Mrs. Jebediah.
"Please do not feel that you owe me any explanations, Mrs. Jebediah. Your great kindness has been enough."
Mrs. Jebediah didn't answer for a while. Charlotte began to wonder if she shouldn't take her leave when Mrs. Jebediah tucked a non-existent stray strand of hair behind her ear and said,
"But will you listen to an explanation?"
"Of course."
"As you've so capably deduced, I am a woman widowed before my time, and it was all the more bitter because my husband had not only been young, he had been a good 11 years junior to me. One of the reasons I resisted his entreaties of marriage from near and far for as long as I did. I was younger then, but I dreaded the day when he would still be in his prime and I would have already descended into old age. Even when I finally decided to throw caution to the wind, I did so while making jokes about being mistaken for his mother one of those days, or at best, his dear old aunt. I never thought God would take him first. That instead of dreading the appearance of each new wrinkle, each new white hair, I could only wish he were here to witness my inevitable aging."
Charlotte found herself with a lump in her throat. She ate another strawberry.
"In the 6 years since he passed away, I've kept myself busy looking after my niece, who had lived with me all her life. but last year she moved to Paris to study medicine. And while I couldn't be more proud of her, I'm alone in a large house and at a loss over what to do. Not that there aren't things to do, but I don't wish to do them all by myself. And of course I have no plan to recall my niece. This is her time to spread her wings. So I thought I'd find myself a companion. I wrote to a few registries and was sent some candidates to interview. But the moment they saw my photographs from my days on stage, gallivanting in hose and breeches, they couldn't swallow their tea and get out fast enough. Mustn't have their respectability tampered by association. And then they'd storm back to their registries and fume about my disrepute. She spoke lightly, but Charlotte couldn't imagine that it would have been easy for her to swallow the rejections. After that, I had no choice but to advertise in the papers. But how can you be sure that your candidates will be suitable? Lady Holmes always suspected the servants to be full of sloth and thievery. Livia, as great a pessimist as ever lived, simply assumed that the staff, like the rest of the world, despised her on sight and would inevitably take advantage of her. Charlotte didn't share their views, but seeking a lady's companion directly via the back of the newspaper was probably not the best way to find qualified candidates. And if she were a qualified candidate herself, she'd be leery of such an advert, wondering why a potential employer didn't obtain recommendation from friends or use the service of a registry, wondering whether it wasn't instead the work of a confidence artist. Well, I placed another advert, this one for finding a long-lost daughter, and I made sure the two adverts are set close together, in the same region on the page but in different columns, explained Mrs. Jebediah, who wasn't really Mrs. Jebediah. And, of course, the two adverts direct potential applicants to write to two different women at two different post offices. Charlotte clapped her hands together.
Aha! At my previous boarding home, one of the women read aloud your lost daughter advert. I see your ruse. If a candidate answers both adverts, then she is clearly not to be trusted.
Precisely. And has this method helped you eliminate some candidates? All of them, except one. That is, one woman who hasn't written about the lady's companion position, but seems to be most sincerely seeking her mother, which makes me feel terrible for possibly having given her hope when none existed. Mrs. Jebediah smiled a little. You are correct, Miss Holmes. I am running a scheme, only not a successful one, at least not for me. A fine carriage drew up before the tea shop. Oh, that's mine, she said, which reminds me that I have an appointment to keep. She rose. A look of alarm must have crossed Charlotte's face, for she added, And the bill has already been settled. I would not dream of saddling you with it, my dear. Charlotte's face heated. She didn't believe Mrs. Jebediah was the sort to indulge in such frauds. But then again, she had read the mother and daughter beggar team completely wrong, too. The thought never occurred to me. Thank you most kindly for tea, ma'am. I'm sure we will run into each other again at the post office, Miss Holmes. Mrs. Jebediah swept out and entered the carriage. The gaze of everyone in the tea shop and half of the pedestrians on the street affixed to her person. Charlotte was full, what a marvellous feeling, but she remained at the table, and without any hurry, polished off the last small clumps of scrambled eggs, the last crumbs of the ham pie, and the last two divine strawberries. Alas, the potted chicken was already all gone, the inside of the ramekin as empty as Charlotte's appointment book. Only as she finally rose did she see Mrs. Jebediah's reticule, left behind on a chair. 11.
The woman who wasn't named Mrs. Jebediah stood before her wedding photograph, gazing at the radiant bridegroom who would remain forever young. Her hand trembled slightly as she lifted a glass of sherry to her lips. Mears, her faithful butler, walked into the room. "Ma'am, a young lady to see you," she said. "You may show her in." She could very well regret it before the night was out, but Mrs. Not Jebediah had come to a decision, an important decision. She set aside the sherry glass and took a seat in her favourite chair. Footsteps came up the stairs. The young woman who entered in Mears's wake, however, was not Miss Holmes, but someone she had never seen before. "Miss Hartford," announced Mears, and withdrew. Miss Hartford was about the same age as Miss Holmes, but the similarity ended there. She was thin, hunched, and remarkably dowdy for one so young, ill-fitting dress, drooping bonnet, and spectacles that insisted on sliding down her nose. "Mrs. Jebediah?" she asked tentatively. Mrs. Not Jebediah blinked. She was only Mrs. Jebediah in the advert for the fictional long-lost daughter, and she had never given her private address in that context, not even to the newspaper.
"Mrs. Jebediah, my name is Ellie Hartford. I'm mighty sorry to call so late, but I work as a cook's assistant at the Dog and Duck in Bywater, and they didn't let me out any sooner."
"Oh."
"A few days ago, the barmaid at the pub showed me the paper. Ain't you always said you was dropped on the doorsteps of Westminster Abbey, love? Well, here be a lady looking for her baby, what was..."
"You may stop right there, Miss Hartford," came another voice. "Miss Holmes." Miss Hartford glanced at Miss Holmes, and then she stared, as if unable to believe such a severe command could issue from someone who looked as if she'd freshly stepped off a Valentine card, all wide eyes and blonde ringlets.
"What right you got to tell me to stop? There ain't other babies left at Westminster Abbey. There's... For a woman who works as a cook's assistant in a pub, you certainly arrived in a very nice carriage, which is waiting for you around the corner with a well-dressed gentleman sitting inside."
Miss Hartford took a step toward Miss Holmes.
"You're lying. You'll do anything to claim Mrs. Jebediah as your own mum, won't you?"
"I certainly wouldn't. I happen to know exactly where my mother is, and she would be very cross with me, not that she isn't already, if I dared to find myself a new mother."
"Then what are you doing here?"
"I came to return Mrs. Jebediah's reticule, which she left behind when we took tea together."
"Oh," said Miss Hartford, at a loss for further words.
"I believe you intend to show yourself out, Miss Hartford," said Miss Holmes, her voice cool.
Miss Hartford lifted her chin.
"I sure ain't staying for more insults."
She flounced out with great vigour. Mrs. Not Jebediah stared in the direction of her departure, still not sure what had taken place.
"I apologise for shooing off your caller, Mrs. Watson," said Miss Holmes softly. "It is Mrs. Watson, is it not? Mrs. John Watson?"
Mrs. Watson realized she was on her feet and slowly sat down again.
"How did you find out, Miss Holmes?"
"I enjoy fashion. I recognize that your hats are from Madame Claudette's on Regent Street. Chances are not that many clients ask to have little black crepe details appended to their millinery. So I went to the shop, knocked on the living quarters, and told the women inside that I'd met you on the train, that you'd left your reticule behind with no address to be found inside, and that the only way to return it was to identify you via your hat. They were very glad to help."
"Thank you for taking the trouble."
Mrs. Watson sounded tremulous to herself, as if she were the woman in dire straits who'd been helped, rather than the other way around.
"I should be the one to thank you," for taking the trouble.
I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
Miss Holmes smiled. She had dimples. Of course she did. The good Lord went to ridiculous lengths to make sure that one of the finest minds in existence was housed in a body least likely to be suspected of it. I can accept that a kind-hearted woman would want to feed a stranger a good meal, said Miss Holmes. But when she also leaves her reticule behind, a reticule that contains far too much money for a trip across town, in far too usable a combination of coins and notes, I begin to ask questions. I begin to wonder whether it is merely my luck or your design. The butler returned with the tea service.
Thank you, Mr. Mears, said Mrs. Watson.
Mears left silently. Mrs. Watson poured for her guest, her fingers tight around the handle of the teapot.
Both milk and sugar, if I recall correctly, Miss Holmes.
Yes, please. Mrs. Watson couldn't remember the last time she saw anyone's face light up at the sight of a cup of tea. Miss Holmes half closed her eyes as she took that first sip.
Some macaroons, perhaps?
Asked Mrs. Watson, gesturing toward the plates of comestibles that had been brought in with the tea. She had appeared before audiences of thousands, and yet now she was nervous before an audience of one.
And if you like cake, the Madeira is very good. But if I do say so, my cook makes the best plum cake I've ever tasted.
I don't believe I've ever turned down plum cake in my life, and I certainly won't start now, answered Miss Holmes, helping herself to a slice. Oh, you are right. This is scrumptious, absolutely scrumptious. Mrs. Watson smiled with some effort.
I'm glad you agree.
She took a macaroon so that she too would have something to do while Miss Holmes polished off her slice of cake. When Miss Holmes finished, she sighed. Mrs. Watson half hoped she would take another slice. The girls certainly had the appetite for it. But Miss Holmes set down her plate and folded her hands neatly in her lap.
Thank you. You are so very, very kind, she said, gazing fully upon Mrs. Watson. Her eyes were clear and remarkably guileless.
Mrs. Watson, blood pounding in her ears, braced herself for what was coming.
You know who I am, don't you, Mrs. Watson?
Asked Miss Holmes.
You know my story.
Charlotte watched as Mrs. Watson stirred her tea. Here in her own home she was dressed more plainly, in a russet velvet dress that Livia might almost approve of, if not for the gold piping that trimmed the flounces of the skirt. The interior of the house was also conservatively furnished, without the wild prints and Eastern influences that one often associated with more bohemian decor. In fact, if it weren't for the stage photographs, a caller might think herself in the drawing-room of an ordinary, respectable widow. A kind and beautiful one, but otherwise unexceptional. The photographs told a different story altogether. Charlotte, no stranger to flouting conventional mores these days, was more than a little taken aback by images of a young Mrs. Watson in hose and breeches. A woman's lower limbs were always enshrouded by layers of skirts. Even bloomers worn by the brave and athletic few were purposefully billowy to hide the exact form of the wearer. Of course there were postcards of scantily clad actresses, but to see the sight of one's hostess's calves and thighs so obviously and deliberately outlined, she could only imagine the shock of those applicants who had come hoping to become Mrs. Watson's companion. Mrs. Watson followed Charlotte's line of sight.
The public considers all women on stage to be of questionable morals, if not outright whores. but the serious Shakespearean actresses console themselves that at least they aren't involved in the vulgarity of musical theatre. And those of us in musical theatre congratulate ourselves on not being involved in the pornographic nonsense that is the burlesque. I don't know to whom the burlesque performers compare themselves, but I'm sure they feel superior to someone. Charlotte sighed.
My sister fears becoming an impoverished old maid. Sometimes I think that more than eating boiled cabbage in a dilapidated boarding house, she fears becoming the most pathetic person she knows, to have no one before whom she could feel the least bit superior.
Mrs. Watson set aside her teacup without drinking from it. What do you fear the most, Miss Holmes? Charlotte exhaled. She knew what she feared, but she wasn't accustomed to voicing it aloud.
I fear always being beholden to someone else. I want to be independent, and I want to earn that independence. But now I can no longer believe that fortunate state of affairs will ever come to pass. Not with all the mistakes I've made.
Is there someone specific you have in mind, that you don't wish to be beholden to? Charlotte hesitated.
My father has a natural son. It wasn't common knowledge.
Charlotte only found out because she wanted to know why Lady Amelia had in the end jilted Sir Henry. This might not be the only reason, but for someone of Lady Amelia's lofty background, marrying a mere baronet would already be a step down. That he had sired a child out of wedlock, hardly an unforgivable sin under normal circumstances, might have tilted the balance against him.
"Oh," said Mrs. Watson. "My half-brother lives in London and works as an accountant."
"And you consider him your last resort?" Charlotte hesitated again.
"I don't know anything about him. Though I dare say he has no reason to feel any sympathy for me. I didn't have the hurdles of illegitimacy placed in my path, and yet I've managed to bungle everything."
She blew out a breath and eyed the plate of plum cake. Was it appetite or gluttony that made her want to reach out for another slice? Or was it fear, and fear alone? She looked back at Mrs. Watson.
"I guess you've answered my question, ma'am. You do know who I am."
Mrs. Watson picked up a piece of macaroon and took a delicate nibble. "It must have been 3 years ago that I first noticed you at the opera. I remarked that you were probably the most darling young woman present. In return, I was told that you were in fact the greatest eccentric in that crowd of thousands. As you can imagine, that left an impression. I've seen you a few times since, at the park or coming out of the modistes with your mother. After the scandal erupted, well, the separation between society and the demi-monde has always been porous, and I quickly learned of your misfortune. And when I walked into the post office a few days ago and saw you looking pale and distressed, I decided that if I came across you again, I would try to help you.
I cannot tell you how much I cherish your generosity, but it's no pittance that you left me in that reticule, and I'm not in such desperate straits yet that I can simply take the money without second thoughts."
Mrs. Watson smiled. "I cooked up my little scheme before I truly knew anything about you. The moment I stepped out of the tea shop, I realized that it wasn't going to work. I'd left no identifying information in the reticule. But you knew so much about me from a look, it would be only a matter of time before you discovered my address.
I didn't mean to call upon you. My intention was only to ring the doorbell and give the reticule to a member of the staff. But as I approached the house, I saw Miss Hartford emerge from a carriage far too grand for her supposed station in life. She turned around and said to someone in the carriage, 'How do I sound?
and a man's voice replied in a similarly exaggerated accent,
"Like a proper cockney, love."
It made me uneasy. She was still some distance ahead of me. When I turned the corner and saw that she'd been admitted into your house, I went back to the carriage, knocked, and asked for directions to the Strand, claiming to be lost.
I imagine the young man in the carriage must have bent over backward to help you.
Charlotte smiled slightly. He was very chivalrous, and even brought out a map of London to help me orient myself. After I spoke with him, however, I became even more suspicious about his purpose here. So when I did knock on your door, instead of merely handing over the reticule, I asked to be brought to you. And a moment outside the drawing room was enough to let me know what Miss Hartford wanted.
I did think her accent was put on, said Mrs. Watson.
She's a talented mimic, but she'd entered into it with too much enthusiasm and sounded as if a Punch caricature had come to life. Perhaps it would be a good idea to retract the advert. I imagine you wouldn't wish for any more young women to show up at your door trying to claim you as a mother, whether they are sincere or intent on swindle.
You are right, said Mrs. Watson. The experiment has run its course.
Something in her tone struck Charlotte. Mrs. Watson of this evening was different from the exuberant woman she had been earlier in the day. Quieter, more solemn, and more apprehensive. She rose from her seat and walked to the mantel. There she stood with her back to the room, studying a row of framed photographs. Many featured a dark-haired young man with a steady but mischievous gaze. He was in uniform in their wedding photograph. The army, then. Dead 6 years, according to what Mrs. Watson had told Charlotte. And 6 years ago there had been a war with Afghanistan. Distant colonial wars that one read about in the newspapers were like theatrical plays, vivid and dramatic. One could get caught up in the excitement of the battle, the unexpected turns of events, the high passions in the halls of Parliament. But in the end they didn't seem quite real. At least, they had never felt real to Charlotte before this moment. Before she stared at Mrs. Watson's elegant back and saw thousands of dead men strewn across a harsh brown landscape. Mrs. Watson turned around. Charlotte half expected to see the very embodiment of grief and fragility. Instead, she was reminded of the reason she had intuited that Mrs. Watson had been successful on the stage. She exuded a sturdy confidence. That of a woman who trusted herself because of a lifetime of good choices.
Shortly before you arrived, I came to a decision, said Mrs. Watson, her voice soft, her tone firm. I knew it wouldn't be long before you called, bearing my reticule, and that would be an excellent opportunity to offer you the position of a lady's companion.
This development Charlotte had entirely failed to foresee. Her lips flapped a few times before she managed a reply. Me? To you?
We do have a lack of respectability in common, don't you think?
It isn't your disregard of my scandalous recent past that astonishes me, ma'am. Most people tend to want nothing to do with me after I enumerate what I see about them. In fact, it had been a singularly effective means to persuade a gentleman to withdraw a proposal of marriage. Mrs. Watson smiled wryly.
I can see why. It was extraordinarily uncomfortable to be laid so bare. But in my case it was also a tremendous relief. I stopped wearing mourning after the regulation period. I had a young girl under my care and I wanted her to see that life went on, that the loss of a man, even if he had been the love of her life, was not the end of a woman's existence, that such a loss was something she could recover from, with both courage and grace. But now that my niece is away in Paris,
Now that I have no audience for whom to perform this role of the merry widow, I... She pulled out a handkerchief that had been tucked into her sleeve, straightened it, and then tucked it back in. In any case, I thought, let me try it. Let me try having as a companion someone before whom it is useless to pretend that everything is all right. Let me try living without hiding my grief, because to her that grief would already be plain as day. For a minute, neither of them said anything. Mrs. Watson retook her seat and looked at Charlotte. "Will you take the position, Miss Holmes?" "Would she?" Charlotte left her seat and walked to a window. It gave on to the same street where Miss Hartford's carriage had been parked, waiting for her return. The carriage was gone, but in its place a man stood underneath a street lamp, reading a newspaper. At first she thought he was the man from the carriage. Instead, she recognized him as the one who had waited out the rain across the street from her earlier in the afternoon, the one she'd suspected of following her. She was not alarmed. Whoever had commissioned the man's service had not done so with the intention of harming her, but to keep an eye on her. This did not make her happy. She did not care to be closely monitored. She wasn't angry at the person responsible for this surveillance. In his place, she might have done the same. Nevertheless, she wished her secret guardian hadn't felt compelled to be so positioned as to be able to effect a rescue at any moment. It implied that such a rescue was not only necessary but imminent, that she couldn't in good conscience, or cold logic, disagree with the assessment, made it feel as if the air was slowly leaking from her lungs. Of course she would have preferred to pull herself out of her difficulties by her own competence alone. That, however, was not the world in which she lived. If accepting the kindness of a stranger would stabilize her situation and give her another chance at ultimately improving not only her own lot but Livia's too, then she must set aside her pride and do what was necessary. She turned around. Mrs. Watson was still working on the same macaroon. She glanced up at Charlotte, her gaze kind but uncertain. "You are absolutely sure you wish to have me as a companion, ma'am?" Charlotte asked. Mrs. Watson set down the remainder of the macaroon. "Yes, I am." "Then I will accept the position. Gladly. And with much gratitude. Dearest Livia, I have a position, and not just any position, but one that provides good wages, light duties, and excellent accommodation. In fact, I am sitting in my new room, which boasts of a four-poster silk-draped bed, a painting of a lovely and abrupt sea coast, that must surely belong to the Impressionist school of works, and a view of Regent Park outside my window. Not that I can see much now, it being late in the evening. My belongings have been conveyed from the boarding home where I had been staying. They fit perfectly into my new wardrobe. Nothing looks out of place. My brushes on the vanity, my typewriter on the desk, even my magnifying glass on the nightstand. It is as if this room has been waiting for me to arrive and make myself at home. I'm a lady's companion. And now that you have gathered yourself from where you had fallen on the floor, allow me to repeat myself. I am a lady's companion. Not a society lady, obviously. And most definitely not a matron or rich spinster of the grand bourgeoisie. They care more about respectability than even we do. But a lady of the demi-monde, a former stage performer, comfortably off and most amiable. Please do not worry that I might have been ensnared into some scheme. My new employer is both sensible and kind, and I have found not only employment, but acceptance.
My only worry is that I shall manage to repel her when I have every intention to the opposite. For the moment I will not set down my new address. The last thing I want is for this letter to fall into the wrong hands, and Mama to show up at my benefactor's front door in a fit of trembling outrage. You know she would, whatever Papa's orders to the contrary, if she heard that I, in my exile, had taken up with an actress. I will post this letter first thing in the morning, and hope that by afternoon, when I go to the post office on St. Martin's Le Grand, I will already have a response from you. God bless the 11 times a day delivery in this great city, and may it bring your words to me at the very earliest hour. Charlotte. Charlotte had, as usual, chosen to paint an optimistic picture for Livia. To put it mildly, she was ill-suited to acting as a lady's companion. It hadn't been merely greed that had made her decide on becoming a headmistress at a girls' school. It had also been the autonomy, the authority, and last but not least of all, the relative isolation of power. A headmistress made all the decisions, and she was not expected to make friends. To be paid £500 a year to be aloofly in charge, well, it would have been earthly paradise. A position as a lady's companion offered none of what she sought to gain in employment. A lady's companion was a professional appendage, the spare legs to walk upstairs to fetch the needlework, the extra voice to read the paper aloud in the evening, the additional body in the house, so rooms didn't echo with emptiness. In her specific case, however, it wasn't this impersonal servility that concerned Charlotte, but her new employer's lack of prior experience with other companions and her general high opinion of Charlotte's mind. She was worried that Mrs. Watson would think it demeaned Charlotte to be asked to fetch needlework or read out loud from the paper, that she would, in the end, have too little to do. And Mrs. Watson... She also worried about Mrs. Watson. Charlotte was an acceptable conversationalist when the conversation revolved around weather, fashion, and the goings-on of the season. But the deepest feelings of others were always a mystery to her. Not that she didn't know what sentiments were and how to read them, but she herself didn't seem to experience life in quite the same emotion-driven manner. Her days were catalogued as facts and factual observations. She sometimes thought of herself as a combination of a phonographic cylinder and a motion picture camera, which inventors were still working on, that moved through life recording everything she saw and heard. Sometimes she mentally annotated certain moments. Most often she let them pass into memory without comments, as only sounds and moving images. It was in her adolescence that she discovered most people's memories worked nothing like hers. For them, the only indelible elements in the dossiers of a life were the emotions. They might not remember when, where, or with whom something happened, or be reliable in their recall. But by God, that joy, that anguish, that stab of pure hatred, the emotions lost none of their power and potency. She accepted it. She couldn't understand it viscerally, but she accepted that she was the odd man out, and that in this, as in most other respects, the norm did not remotely describe her experience. How could someone like her comment on Mrs. Watson's grief, if she were ever asked to? Therefore, she was more than a little relieved when Mrs. Watson made no mention of her late husband the next day. Mrs. Watson also gave no list of regular duties Charlotte was to perform. "It's new to me, too, such an arrangement," she said apologetically. "I'm sure in time we will arrive at a state of affairs that suits both of us." Charlotte debated whether to mention her great willingness to fetch items, and decided to wait a day or two. Mrs. Watson did formally introduce her to the staff.
Mr. Mears, the butler, Madame Gascoigne, the cook, Polly and Rosie Banning, a pair of sisters who shared housemaid and kitchenmaid duties, and Paul Lawson, Mrs. Watson's groom and coachman. Mr. Mears painted in his spare time. Madame Gascoigne was Belgian, not French, and not from the French-speaking part of Belgium. And while the Banning sisters might have grown up in the same household, they were not actually related by blood. All of which was fine, except...
"I'm not sure whether it's my place to bring it up, Mrs. Watson," said Charlotte when she and her employer took a walk in Regent Park. "But I'm strongly persuaded that Mr. Lawson has spent some time in a penitentiary."
"And so he has," replied Mrs. Watson, not at all alarmed. "Into many lives a little irregularity must fall." Considering the amount of irregularities that had fallen into her own life of late, Charlotte could only nod.
"How right you are, ma'am."
Post-lunch, Mrs. Watson took a nap, giving Charlotte plenty of time to write another letter to Livia. She also attempted to draft a letter to a different recipient, but gave up after half a dozen attempts. Later that afternoon, Mrs. Watson had herself and Charlotte driven to the general post office. In the morning, Mrs. Watson had already written to the papers, instructing them to stop printing her adverts, but she expected it would be a few days before inquiries stopped arriving. Charlotte had nothing from Livia. Her letters arrived in fits and starts, whenever she could get them to Mott, and whenever Mott could post them. There was, however, something from Inspector Robert Treddles of the Metropolitan Police. "Miss Holmes," asked Mrs. Watson, as their carriage rolled away from the curb, "did I hear you call for letters for a certain Sherlock Holmes?" There was only curiosity on Mrs. Watson's face. Charlotte decided to tell the truth.
"Yes, you did."
Mrs. Watson leaned forward. "Would that happen to be the same Sherlock Holmes who wrote the letter to the coroner that has all of London society in an uproar?"
"That's the alias I used."
"You are Sherlock Holmes?" Still no censure on Mrs. Watson's part.
"I thought calling myself Charles Holmes would have been too obvious. Sherlock is similar enough to Charlotte without being its exact masculine equivalent."
Mrs. Watson leaned back in her seat.
"This makes perfect sense now. You wrote the letter to lift the siege around your sister.
The best way to prove her innocence is to discover the truth. Do you really believe that those three deaths are part of a larger scheme? I could not convince myself that they were all simply a coincidence."
She glanced down at the letter in her hand.
"I hope Inspector Treddles has some good news for me."
"You know someone in Scotland Yard?"
"I don't know him personally, but Sherlock Holmes has consulted for him a few times, via a mutual friend."
"Then why don't you read his note? You must be anxious to know what it says."
Charlotte did not need to be urged again. "Dear Mr. Holmes, I have been looking into the Sackville case at Lord Ingram's request, but while I have come across tantalizing clues and insights, I have unearthed nothing concrete. Nothing that would convince a coroner's jury, let alone be deployed as Crown's evidence. Time is running out. The inquest reconvenes tomorrow afternoon. I need hardly state that if you have any special insights that would aid me in the investigation, sir, it would be well to convey them at your earliest convenience. Sincerely yours, Robert Treddles. P.S. My best wishes for your speedy recovery."
"The news is not encouraging, I take it," said Mrs. Watson.
Charlotte handed over the letter for Mrs. Watson to read herself. Mrs. Watson scanned the lines.
"What will you do now?"
Charlotte pressed a finger against her lips.
His letter is dated today, which means there is still time before the inquest reconvenes. I must arrange a meeting with him.
As yourself?
Not at this crucial moment, I don't believe. Men had a tendency to discount a woman.